Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. My name is Alison Van Diggelen. I'm a host of Fresh Dialogues and a BBC contributor. It's my pleasure to introduce John Mackey. He's co-founder and CEO of Whole Foods Market and co-author of The Whole Foods Diet, the life-saving plan for health and longevity. In 1978, John co-founded his first healthcare food store, Safer Way, in Austin, Texas. 2 years later, the store merged with Clarksville Natural Grocery and was renamed Whole Foods Market. Since going public in 92, Whole Foods has grown into a $16 billion Fortune 500 company with more than 400 stores across the U.S., Canada, and the United Kingdom. It has over 90,000 employees. John has been instrumental in the organic food movement and has led Whole Foods in setting standards for the humane treatment of animals. He helped launch the Whole Food Planet Foundation to help end poverty in developing nations and continues to promote healthy eating education for Whole Foods team members and customers to reduce some of the country's most serious health problems, including obesity, diabetes, and heart disease. John is co-founder of the Conscious Capitalism Institute and sits on the board of directors of Farm Forward and the Humane Society of the United States. We're also joined tonight by John's friend and colleague, Dr. John McDougall. He's often referred to as one of the founding fathers of the Natural Wellness Program. He's founder and director of the nationally renowned McDougall Program in Santa Rosa, California, that he runs with his wife, Mary. He also co-founded Dr. McDougall's Right Foods, Inc., which produces dried and packaged soups and meals. So please join me in welcoming the two Johns. So thank you both for joining me this evening. So, John Mackey, I would like to start with you. If you could share with the audience your motivation for writing this book, because you've done a lot for organic food and eating healthy, but why a book and why now?
This is a bucket list book. This is a book I had to write. So, I mean, it's an ethical thing, too. Imagine that you... I mean, America's 71% overweight, 38% obese. We still are dying by the millions of heart disease, cancer, diabetes. And imagine you knew how to help people. There is an ethical compunction to try to do something about that, to try to communicate what you know. And at Whole Foods, we have a program we call the Total Health Immersion. We've now sent over 4,000 team members, our sickest team members, those who are obese, those who have type 2 diabetes, those who have heart disease, and those who have or very high biometrics that indicate they're high risk for those diseases. And we've sent 4,000 through. And in fact, Dr. McDougall is one of the doctors we work with. We work with different doctors around the country, and we've reversed type 2 diabetes hundreds of times. That's a disease you can cure in less than 30 days through just dietary changes. We've reversed heart disease. We've seen hundreds of team members lose over 100 pounds of weight in less than a year. So, Americans are so confused about diet and health. I just felt like if Matt and Alona, the doctors who co-wrote the book with me, we all felt sort of an ethical necessity to write the book and try to reach people and help people if we can.
And Dr. John McDougall, can you share what you contributed? What was your biggest contribution to this book, would you say?
I guess I stood as a, kind of a pillar for John because, you know, I'm a medical doctor and an internist, and I've been practicing for a half a century, 40 years of doing this. And when John and I became friends over a decade ago, he had already read my books, and I guess if I was going to speak for John, I would say that I served as a scientific and clinical landmark for him to advance things that he believed in from an ethical, an environmental, an animal rights, and a health point of view, and also tremendous care for his employees. So if I would have to speak for myself and say what my role in this book was, is to provide that kind of enthusiastic medical and scientific background so that John could write the things that he believes in so much, not just believes in, but practices in dedicating a large amount of money, time, effort, and enthusiasm to make his employees, his team members, the healthiest employees in the world. There are only a couple companies that have that foresight. So hopefully that's the way John looks at my contribution.
Great. So John, you start the book by talking about growing up in Texas. You talk about the typical day's diet.
Don't tell people in California you grew up in Texas. Okay?
we'll forgive you. But you talk about the cocoa puffs, the bacon, the mac and cheese. So with that kind of upbringing, which is probably common to many people here, how did you change from that to being one of the leading advocates for this whole foods diet?
I think in my own sort of, we're all on a journey to health, and I went through several recognizable phases in my own journey. The first journey when I was about 23 years old, I grew up eating the standard American diet. I ate a very unhealthy diet. I played basketball, I played sports, so I had some fitness, but I didn't have any health because my diet was so poor. And I moved in this vegetarian co-op when I was 23 years old in Austin. And I was not a vegetarian, but I actually moved in there. I was definitely into the counterculture back in the middle 1970s, early 1970s, middle 1970s. And I just thought I'd meet some super cool people in a vegetarian co-op. And I did. And I became a vegetarian, and I had my first kind of food consciousness awakening in that co-op. Became a vegetarian. I learned how to cook. I became the food buyer for the co-op, and I started to feel better. I was amazed at how much better I felt, and that was kind of my first awakening, and that led to me dropping out of college and starting up Whole Foods Market. It's like, this is what I wanted to do. I was on fire about healthy eating, natural, organic, and my first store, Safeway, was this super healthy store. I mean, it was vegetarian. Back then I had never heard of the word vegan. That word was only invented in like 1944, and there was no widespread consciousness in the 70s about it. So it was, to be a vegetarian was a very radical act back in the middle 70s. And most people were lacto ovo vegetarians. And we didn't sell any sugar, we didn't sell any white flour, we didn't sell any alcohol, we didn't sell any coffee. It was like the super pure store. It also did almost no business. And it wasn't really until we merged with another store and they insisted on selling the foods that we thought people wanted to eat. So it was a natural food store, an organic store, but it just sold coffee, it sold beer and wine, it began to sell meat, began to sell fish, began to sell some sugar. And that store quickly became the highest volume natural food store in the United States within a few months of opening. So ultimately, a business has to sell what customers want to buy. There would be nothing I would like better than for our customers to stop buying animal foods. That's a fact. That's what I wish. But actually, the people have to make those decisions themselves. I've just written a book, and I doubt any of these protesters have actually read chapter 13 of that book, where I make the ethical case for not eating any animal foods. But you have to meet the marketplace where you find it. And in any kind of movement, they're always going to be the purist, and they're always going to be the pragmatist. The purist, they have great judgment for people like myself, who they see as a heretic or a hypocrite or a liar. But I would contend at the end of the day, it's the pragmatist that actually changed the world. It's the pragmatist that make things better. And that's what I am. I'm a pragmatist. I have my ideals, and I never forget them. I'm always moving towards them. But you meet people where you find them, and you help people where you find them. And it may feel very good to be judgmental and be holy, holier than thou, but you will do very little good in the world. That is what I have discovered. You have to meet the marketplace where you find it, and you make changes that way. So it is ironical to me, though, that pretty much any time I go out and speak in public, I have protesters against Whole Foods when we're the ones trying to actually do the best. Are we perfect? No, we're not. I mean, we make mistakes. We're humans. We are trying to do the best that we can in this issue.
What have you done to make the food products at Whole Foods more ethically raised? What can you itemize a couple of things that you've done?
Well, what we did was, when I had my kind of next food awakening, which occurred in 2003, and it's, I almost hesitate to tell this story because it encourages more protesters, but in 2003, Whole Foods Market was having its annual meeting in Santa Monica, California, and we had protesters show up from PETA and Viva. And they were upset because we were selling ducks that were from, they believed, a factory farm. And they thought it was very unethical. And they disrupted our meeting, and it was a mess. But I began a dialogue with one of the protesters after that annual meeting. And we swapped emails, and we began an email correspondence. And her name was Lauren Ornelius, who actually still lives in the Bay Area. So I began this conversation with her, and Lauren, after a while, she got very frustrated with me because she said, you know, Mr. Mackey, I can see you're a very idealistic man, but when it comes to livestock animals, you don't know what you're talking about. You're not very well informed. And I was taken aback. And she said, and furthermore, you're running a pretty big corporation. You really kind of owe it to people to be better informed on these issues. So that summer, I read about a dozen books on the way we raise livestock animals in America, and I was like totally horrified. It was horrible. It was absolutely horrible. And I made two decisions that summer. One was I was going to stop eating animals, any kind of animal products at all, period. I was definitely felt that was the right thing for me personally. And then secondly, I said, you know, Whole Foods is going to do something about this. We're going to try to begin to raise standards. And to make a long story short, we brought animal activists, we brought scientists, we brought the farmers and ranchers together, and we began to work out a system where we would rate the level of animal welfare. Now, we're not calling it humane, but just rating so people would have more transparency on the animal foods they ate, and that led to our five-step program. And again, that we don't claim that's a perfect system. It just means people can make more informed choices. So anyway, that's kind of the story there. And I think the protesters don't like the idea of a system like this because, as the founder of PETA told me, this is preventing people from becoming vegans. And you are helping people to rationalize guilty consciences by believing they're eating more humanely raised stuff when it's all murder. Meat is murder. And you shouldn't do anything that actually helps the animals because that will keep people from becoming vegans. And it's like, hello, Ingrid, it's only like 2% of the population are vegans, okay? And yet we're killing 10 billion livestock animals a year. They're suffering. We can do things to make their suffering less. And that is the practical, pragmatic way to approach these things. And that's what Whole Foods has chosen to do. But others disagree, and we're in America, so they can disagree. I just wish they'd stop following me around wherever I go.
Okay, so, John, going back to the book, it was powerful to read about your personal health stats. You talk about your cholesterol levels and your blood pressure levels. Talk about that, what the timeline was for that.
My blood pressure is a bit higher right now. Generally, it's pretty low.
But talk about the health effects of this vegan diet.
Well, first, it's not a vegan diet. And the Whole Foods diet, to be clear, it has two rules in it. So maybe it gives a chance to talk a little bit about the book. It has two rules. First, and most importantly, we should eat whole foods. We should eat real foods. Stop eating all of the processed foods. Those are basically poison for us. We eat way too much sugar, refined grains, vegetable oils. I mean, Americans, if you take a pie chart of what Americans eat, and this is in the book, 54% of the calories Americans eat come from hyper-processed foods, 54%. 32% come from animal foods, and only 14% come from whole plant foods, when we should be eating at least 90% plant food. So stop eating all the junk food. And secondly, eat mostly plants, someplace between 90% and 100%. All three of the authors eat 100%, but we think the science does not prove or does not give an indication that you can eat small quantities of animal foods and have good health. We get into that in the book through the Blue Zones, where Dan Buettner's research identified five places in the world that have very long lives, that have the highest percentage of centenarians in any cultures in the world, in Okinawa, Japan, Icaria, Greece, Sardinia, Italy, Nicoya, Costa Rica, and Loma Linda, California, of all places, where the Seventh-day Adventists live. But when you did a meta-analysis of that, of the diets those folks eat, they eat 90-plus percent whole plant foods. They're not vegans. They're eating a little bit of animal foods, but very small quantities of it. But what they are eating is real foods. They're not eating all the processed junk, and they have excellent health outcomes as a result of that.
Right. But I did say vegan on purpose because that's what you are right now.
You know, the problem is that we tried to write this book to appeal to people about health. There's a strong ethical environmental arguments. We deal with that very, you know, briefly in Chapter 13. So if you're interested in those issues, go to Chapter 13. This is about health.
You know, Whole Foods is a megaphone for our message. And, John, you remember I told you it's better to be hated than ignored?
Yeah,
you have proved this to me right here.
I'm not sure I believe that right now.
I understand what everybody's trying to say, and of course, you and I have had a lot of agreements and a lot of disagreements over time. But the important thing is that we have to make a difference. And in my lifetime of medicine, which is nearly a half a century, things have gotten worse. You know, we knew all this direction back in the 1970s with the U.S. dietary goals, McGovern and Sierra Coop and his publication of Nutrition and Health in America. We knew all about where we needed to go. But the problem is nobody went there. But a few people were bold enough to stand up and speak clearly. And John Mackey is one of those people. And you get people to listen to John. Even though the whole world's getting sicker, at least they're hearing the truth and a different message. So my praise to you.
Well, I've got my bucket list book. Thank you. Thanks, John.
So let's go back to the science of this. Your friend and colleague, Dr. Dean Ornish, wrote the foreword to the book. And he writes, genes are a predisposition, but not usually our fate. And he argues that lifestyle, including diet, can actually change our genes. That, for me, was an epiphany. Can you explain what he means by that?
Well, first, I think I want to point something out about Dr. Ornish, which is, here's a guy that cured heart disease. And he showed us how to cure heart disease, and nobody cares. I mean, it's such a big industry to do stents and do angioplasty and cut people's chest open, and the medical industry makes so much money doing it that nobody's interested in the real cure, which is nobody should get heart disease. It's a dietary disease, and Dr. McDougall has proven that over and over again. And so what did Dean Ornish mean by the genes? He basically says that our genes actually can be, they can change. We can change our genes by our diet and lifestyle and the way we think. And this is the science that shows this to be true now. And that's not common knowledge, because we tend to believe genes are our destiny. If we have genes that predispose us to breast cancer, well, that it's all over. We should cut our breast off. And he's challenging that mythology that our genes are not our destiny. They may predispose us in certain directions, but even the genes themselves can be changed.
You know, I'd like to add that the problems that we have in this country, now in China and India, these problems are diseases we know the causes of. This is not a mystery. This is from eating like kings and queens. It used to be just a few kings and queens. Now there are, well, probably half the people on planet Earth eat like kings and queens. And that's why folks are sick. There's just no money in teaching people what the cause is in curing the problem. Rather, the present medical market is to sell you things that basically don't work. The treatment of chronic coronary artery disease with surgery does not save lives. The diabetic medications that we use for to treat type 2 diabetes, they've been shown in 6 major studies to increase the risk of people dying. These diabetic medications make people fat. You know, they can increase the risk of dying of heart disease. So, I mean, just ask yourselves, you're well-educated people, why is it that we know what the problem is? I mean, if you're as old as John as I are, I want to admit I'm a little older than John. You know, we've seen this transition around the world where in China before 1980, there was virtually no obesity and no type 2 diabetes. But now China brags that 12% of the population are frankly diabetic and half are pre-diabetic. And the same thing goes for obesity. You've seen it in China and Japan and Thailand and in India. This is not a mystery as to why people are sick. I know there are a lot of folks out there who are telling you alternative truths and fake news, but their motivation is not your welfare. It's to increase the sale of diabetic pills, increase the number of heart surgeries done at Stanford for chronic coronary artery disease. And, you know, so why isn't somebody taking the action to solve the problem? It's just not in most people's financial best interest. And you, your spouses, your parents, and your children are suffering from this dishonesty. You know, John Mackey has taken the trouble, even though he's not pure and ethical, he's taken the trouble to come out and tell you, and to stand up, and tell the public without hesitation, including you who are here to protest, that we do know the truth why people are sick and fat because they eat like kings and queens. And then when people used to eat like they did in China, a rice-based diet, or the Mayans and Incas ate, which was a diet based on corn, they didn't have any of the problems like this. They didn't have any heart disease. They didn't have any obesity. They didn't have any multiple sclerosis. They didn't have any rheumatoid arthritis. So, John, you know, even though you are not perfect in everybody's eyes, you're making more difference than anybody else I know.
So, thank you. So I kind of want to talk about what I think are the roots of the dietary problems that we have in America. And if you think about the way we evolved where where people weren't fat. The challenge that humanity's had through most of our evolutionary history is getting enough calories. That's what we were up against. And it was very rare to find calorie-dense food in our evolutionary heritage. When we were out hunting and gathering, or gathering and hunting to be more accurate, the type of fruits and vegetables and berries and tubers and starchy vegetables that we could find, they were not that calorie dense. We had to continually eat. And if we could find some honey, or we found fruit that was really sweet, we'd go for those foods. Those were good indicators of some calorie density. Or if occasionally they were able to pull down a wild animal, that would be a rich source of protein, a little bit more fat, and more calorie-dense foods than they were normally getting. So our evolutionary heritage is we really like things that are calorie-dense. We like things that are sweet. We like things that are fat, have a lot of oil or fat in them, butter, cheese, meat that's particularly been corn-fed or pumped up to gain high weight and a lot more fat. And we crave those things. And what we are today is we're rich enough where we can eat calorie-dense foods every single meal. As John said, we can eat like kings and queens. And that's basically poisoning ourselves. We have got, and it creates these food addictions where we just want to eat really rich food. And many people would actually rather die than change their diets. They feel like, and the reason why is they feel like they would have no more pleasure if they were to give up their diets and change to eat healthy food, that diet would be so boring and so unsatisfying that it's just not worth it. And yet that's such a myth, because we can re-educate our palates to enjoy the healthiest foods in the world with no loss of pleasure, just the opposite, a much greater sense of pleasure, and a greater sense of joy and well-being. So there's no loss of pleasure, but we have to re-educate ourselves to begin to enjoy these foods that are the basic foods, like starch foods, like whole grains and starchy vegetables and beans, fruits and vegetables. And I think those are the keys to the healthy diet.
You know, we could step aside the whole ethical issue if we would educate the population of the world as to what the human diet really is, which is a diet based on starches with fruits and vegetables. That's what we enjoy most. We like a little salt, a little sugar with it. Don't have to eat it, but sure makes it taste good. And if people realize just how unappealing a piece of boiled beef was, and they're making a great effort to turn it into something they can get down their throats at a price tag of, you know, $25 to $100 a meal, after covering it up with all kinds of steak sauce and barbecue sauce and so on. So it's I don't see it as a matter of pleasure. I see it as a matter of purposeful ignorance, purposeful on the part of industry to get us to buy things that we don't really like at all. And the only way they can get us to eat it is to cover up with things that we do really like spices, simple sugars, salt. People do like these things. Of course, in the process of making, quote, tasty foods, they really overdose it, and people suffer some adverse effects from that also.
So we have a number of questions in the audience. You can see my hands are full here. This one is relevant to what you're both talking about. What do you see as the main friction point for the world at large to move towards veganism? If you had a magic wand and you could, you know, one wish, what would you change? What one thing would you or could you change? Is it a food policy or health policy issue?
We're back to calorie density. I mean, if you look at the trend lines, since 1940, animal food consumption went up 70% per capita in the United States. But it's actually been leveled out about 20 years ago, and it's actually slowly declining now, even with the paleo movement as a counterweight. But it's exploding in the rest of the world. As people become more affluent, they crave more calorie density. It's what we're programmed to want. So you have to become more conscious about diet. Otherwise, you will want to eat more. I mean, just take cheese, for example. In the United States, in 1915, we ate about 3 pounds of cheese per capita per year. Today we eat 34.5 pounds per capita. So it's gone up over 1,000% in the last 100 years per capita. John and I don't eat any cheese whatsoever. Therefore, some of you are eating like 69, 70 pounds of cheese. And you know who you are, too. So.
You know, I think we need to start with basic truth. And the problem is industry controls, quote, the alternative truths. I don't believe you or any of your families and your family members want to be sick or dealing with being overweight. But because the messages you are given by industry that you must eat these foods because you need to get the protein or the calcium, this is called unique positioning. This is what industry does to sell you their products. So if I say protein, you say meat. If I say calcium, you say milk. But there's never, ever been a case of calcium or protein deficiency ever reported in the world literature. If I say omega-3 fats, you say fish. No fish ever made an omega-3 fat, ever. No animal can desaturate at the carbon-3 position. Only plants can do it. So just the basic truths that are being hid from you and your families are the first thing I would start from. I would stop the liars. And, you know, if you have the basic information, like we do today about tobacco, when I was a young man, cigarette smokers were encouraged to smoke because of athletes that smoked and beautiful models that smoked, but they stopped that all in 1964 with Luther Terry's report, the Surgeon General's report on smoking and health. As a result, cigarette smoking has gone from half the population to fewer than 20%. That's because people were given the truth about smoking. Same thing with alcohol consumption. It used to be every lunch had to be two martinis.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
But we're in that same problem today, is you have so much money, industry has, that they can give you, as I mentioned, alternative facts, fake news. They can buy everything.
I'm going to interrupt John because I don't agree with him on this particular point. Well, I mean, you're making a business like the protesters into the evil business people who are corrupting the pure and innocent. And certainly business is self-interested, to be sure. However, I mean, it's the calorie density issue. They're selling things to people that people want to buy. Selling ice cream is not a hard sell. Selling cheese is not a hard sell. People like those products.
But what costs more, rice or ice cream?
I'm just saying what people have a predisposition to like those calorie-dense foods. And so that's why oil is in everything. That's why sugar is so ubiquitous. It's because people like it. They want it. They get addicted to it. And, yeah, business, yeah, they're definitely propagandizing it, but the customers want these things or they wouldn't have a market. They couldn't sell. Business is not so powerful that it can actually make people buy things that people really hate. They're buying these things because they enjoy them, and that's a sad truth, but it's nevertheless a truth, which is not to say that business doesn't actually act sometimes unethically, to be sure. But I think it's oversimplification to say this is mainly a problem business corrupting people. I think it's a much deeper issue. It goes into our evolutionary past, and we just really like calorie-dense foods. We crave them.
Right. So let's go back
to the next. Let's move on to the next question.
Yes, absolutely.
I would start by telling the truth, John. And unfortunately, the way the situation is industry has a purpose. They're not evil people. You know, these are not evil farmers. They're people just like you and I, but they have to put shoes on the kids, and they have to keep the stockholders happy. And so they have to deliver a message that favors their product. It's not a conspiracy.
They meet the marketplace where they find it. The very thing I was saying before, John, they're selling. I mean, I had a Pure Store, Safeway. It didn't do any business. People didn't want it.
You wouldn't stay in business.
Well, people want what they want.
So let's go back to the science of this.
you told me you would have gone broke a long time ago if you didn't sell those things.
This is going to be a long evening. In your book, you talk and you cite evidence from the China study. Talk about that, because that has been a book that has changed lives. For example, a very prominent one, Bill Clinton, read that book, I understand, and became a vegan as a result. So talk about some of the key takeaways from the China study. There may be people here who haven't heard of it yet, but it sounds like it's if you want to educate yourself on the science of eating and how it affects your health, it sounds like it's a must read.
Well, I mean, of course, the China study is a long book, so it's hard to summarize very too quickly. But the essence of it is that this is the largest nutritional study actually ever undertaken. It was able to study after Chao and Lai died from cancer, or was dying from cancer. He wanted to understand the cancer patterns better in China, and they began this incredible study where what they found is that basically the places that eat real foods in the rural areas, mostly rice and vegetables, didn't tend to get these type of cancers. They weren't eating very small amounts of animal foods, again, not vegan, but very small percentages. And in the cities where people had access to calorie-dense food and a lot more animal foods, a lot more processed foods, they saw their cancer rates were much, much higher. And so the essence of the China study is similar to what our message here is about the whole foods diet, which is eat real foods, a starch-based diet, lots of vegetables, not too many animal foods. And that seems to be a diet that the Chinese people that ate it in the rural areas would avoid these chronic diseases.
Okay.
And let me be clear, you do not need animal foods for any aspect of your health. Mm-hmm. There's you know, the only argument you could give is B12, and there are lots of other sources of B12. But otherwise, selling animal foods to people makes no nutritional sense at all. It's, again, an alternative fact.
Right. So here's a question for you, Doctor. Any foods that can deter dementia or Alzheimer's?
Yeah, sure there are. Eating a good diet. There's lots of forms of dementia. You can have little strokes, which are caused by eating the rich Western diet, causes atherosclerosis, gives you strokes. Alzheimer's disease, I believe, is due to aluminum poisoning. Yeah, aluminum poisoning. You can get demented from multiple sclerosis, which is a disease.
And how do you get aluminum poisoning?
Well, aluminum is every place. It's in baking powders. It's in all kinds of packaging.
Antiperspirants.
Yeah, antiperspirants, aluminum foil. Aluminum pots and pans when you go to your favorite vegan Chinese restaurant in town. Likely they cook in aluminum pots and pans. And so, you know, I have believed for a long time, and if you take and do a Medline search on Alzheimer's and aluminum, you'll come up with about 800 different articles that say the same. So, yeah, dementia has multiple dietary causes, some environmental poisons, some related to getting a regular stroke or a heart attack.
Okay, so we have a question from the audience. She says she's an Irish girl who grew up on potatoes. And she says, studies have shown eliminating starch helps diseases such as rheumatoid arthritis. What is your take on starch raising inflammation levels in the body?
Oh, my God, you're asking Dr. McDougall about that. This is going to be fun.
Where is this Irish girl?
If you look at the research... You take inflammation as your key marker. Inflammation is the result of injury. The injury comes from the knife and fork. And after you injure the body, the tissues, the arteries, and so on, it produces inflammatory reactions. That's part of healing. But if you don't injure it, like, for example, if you don't smoke cigarettes, you don't injure the lungs, then you don't get inflammation of the lungs. If you don't eat the animal foods, the oils, you don't injure the various tissues of the body and you don't produce inflammation. So the scientific research, and I've reviewed this very carefully, and any of you can too, you have access to Google, you have access to the National Library of Medicine. The information consistently says that plant foods, whole grains, etc., reduce inflammation in the body, and that animal foods dramatically increase the inflammation in the body. And if you believe otherwise, then you haven't read the research.
What about the potatoes? She said potatoes. What about potatoes?
Potatoes have served as the worldwide pillar of nutrition. Potatoes supported civilizations in the Andes for 13,000 years. When the potato was introduced in Europe in the 1700s, malnutrition disappeared. The population of Ireland doubled in 40 years with the introduction of the potato.
Could you live only on potatoes?
You can live only on potatoes. There have been more. Millions of people have had to. Post-World War II in Germany, that's basically all they had. The people in the Andes lived on potatoes. Potatoes are, in my opinion, an ideal food. They're the anti-scurvy food. They're filling, they're tasty. They get ruined when you coat them and fry them in grease. But otherwise, I mean, think of the populations of tens, hundreds of millions of people who have lived on potatoes as their basic diet. Why did the potato all of a sudden become evil? Well, they're cheap.
The poor potato, yes.
And people like them even without the grease and salt on them.
So it's fair to say you don't believe potatoes are responsible.
I love potatoes. And we have, not only are there scientific studies showing people can live only on potatoes, there's a guy called, his name is Andrew Taylor, who's become quite famous around the world because he has lived for a year on potatoes alone and lost about 120 pounds and is in great shape. He's a friend, an advocate, a spokesman of the health benefits of potatoes, and is a direct contrast to the lies that so many people have bought into. Why is a potato bad?
Next question.
Okay, so let's move on from potatoes. So there's a question from the audience about fish. The writer wants to know, The writer has seen the connection between fish and longevity. For example, Okinawa, that's one of the blue zones that was studied. Mm. There is a connection, but you're still advocating for just 10% animal products in your diet. So
before he takes the question, let me try to take a stab at it here. So, first of all, Okinawans do not eat a lot of fish. The elder Okinawans eat 96% plant-based. About 1% of their calories comes from fish. They actually eat as much pork as they eat fish. So, and that's only 4% of their calories. So that's not a true statement. Then there's some evidence in the Seventh-day Adventist study that the pescatarians had the same longevity outcomes as the pure vegans did. They're about neck and neck on that one. But I think, and then if you're going to eat animal foods at all, fish, from a nutritional standpoint, are a little bit more nutritionally dense. Now, those are the good things about fish, but they're also they bioaccumulate toxins, particularly mercury, PCBs, and those can be very harmful to us as we bioaccumulate them as well. And there's strong environmental issues about fish because we are, unless you're shopping in Whole Foods and getting our sustainable seafood, chances are good you are working to not working with sustainable fisheries. So fish is a troubled area. Obviously, John and I don't eat fish. But I think as far as animal foods go, if you're going to eat a little bit of animal foods, you're probably better off eating a little bit of fish. That being said, of course, I don't think it's necessary to eat any fish at all. John?
Can I add or disagree?
That's why I wanted to go
first.
Yeah,
okay. back when I was a young man in the 1950s, there used to be a lot of fish in the ocean. Now 90% of them are gone. The ocean's on the verge of collapse. Even if fish was beneficial to your health and your family in the short term, but it's not. You know, it has all kinds of issues, environmental contamination. There's really nothing contained in fish that you essentially need. You can't get better from other sources. Even if that were true, just from a moral point of view, just for a sustainability of planet Earth, the harvesting of fish should be banned, plain and simple, even if you do sell healthy fish at Whole Foods. And I know you do, and I know it's important, John. And again, that gets back to the point of you being a tremendous communicator because you haven't taken such a hardline attitude about things. You've kept your stores very profitable.
There is that little pesky Seventh-day Adventist study that shows those pescatarians had very good health outcomes. You got to deal with that.
But I think
research.
That's incidental.
Hmm?
I think that's incidental.
I think they're
healthy in spite of the fish,
okay.
The ones that they studied, not because of it. I'm sorry, you know.
So the experts are divided.
Well, John and I are friends. We've been friends for a long time.
That may be coming to an end here. We'll see.
But he didn't invite me to come here and agree, I don't think, exactly.
Yeah, we're having a lively debate.
Yes. Exactly.
Okay. So
John's the megaphone, and you know, he gets a lot more people to pay attention to him than he does than pay attention to me.
You can have all those protesters, John.
I think we scared them all out of the audience, didn't we?
Yes, I think it comes with a price.
Well,
okay, so let's move on. You mentioned the oceans. Let's talk about the environment. John, you have said, I don't think there's a single greater act of environmental activism than moving to a plant-based diet. And you cite the statistic that making meat is a major source of greenhouse gases. It's about 20%. Talk about climate change in the context of this plant-based diet you're advocating.
Well, I have discovered painfully ever talking about climate change in public causes people to hate me, so I've got to be careful here. But no, the facts are that people don't are aware that animal agriculture produces more greenhouse gases collectively than all forms of transportation combined. It is a major contributor to greenhouse gases. There's the effects of the confined animal. The factory farms create massive animal waste, which can pollute our groundwater. There's the issues of the rainforest being chopped down to get more grazing land. As I mentioned previously, the as the world becomes more affluent, as the developed nations develop, they want those calorie-dense food. They want more concentrated protein sources. And so animal foods are exploding around the world, and that's causing much more of our ecology to be put under the plow to raise crops to feed the animals that could be fed directly to people. So there's serious environmental issues with animal agriculture. And I actually think if people really do think of themselves as an environmentalist, that you need to be a conscious environmentalist, and that would require you to curtail or completely eliminate your consumption of animal foods. I think that is the most environmentally responsible single act you could probably do.
So you are...
Can I just add some emphasis to what John said? Is, you know, I think most people here must believe in climate change and there are problems going on. If you don't, we don't even need to have a conversation. But if we're going to save this planet for our children and grandchildren, we have lots of things to do, like improve methods of transportation and energy gathering and, you know, get rid of fossil fuels. But all those things are going to take time for everybody to get an electric car and to get solar panels. That'll take 10, 20 years. We don't have 10 or 20 years. But if our leaders around the world, Prime Minister Modi of India, Mr. Putin of Russia, and I forget what the new president's name is, but Barack Obama and other important people, that was the old one, I remember him. If our leaders would stand up and tell the public what John Mackey's trying to say with Whole Foods, we could make a reduction in environmental damage overnight. Overnight. Whereas it would take you one or two or three decades to fix the other problems. So to give us some breathing room, we've got to get the food problem fixed now, and then we can work, and at the same time we'll be working on changing our modes of transportation and energy gathering. But the food must be fixed now. We don't have time to wait.
I'm very curious. I'm curious to hear your reaction to that, John, because you're a well-known libertarian. Do you feel it is the government's role to take a stance on this?
Trick questions here. It depends. I mean, clearly, we need government regulations. Right? And the government's the umpire that sets certain standards to make sure that we have a good society. So I'm not a libertarian that doesn't believe in, that I'm not an anarchist. I believe in government that's well-defined and stays within its appropriate boundaries. And certainly setting environmental standards is a very important function of good and responsible government. It's always a matter of what standards, to what degree.
So, but do you feel the part of the role of the president is to advocate action on climate change?
You know, I got to tell you that when I go out in public, I've learned that there are really four topics I try not to talk about in public. I try not to talk about politics, religion, sex, or GMOs. Because you're guaranteed to make people angry. I mean, I just can't afford any more protesters wherever I go.
Okay, so let's move on to a question from the audience.
Can I just say, just from my point of view, the government has a role. It's to protect us from foreign and domestic threats. IBM, Apple, they can't build their own armies to protect us from terrorists and invading countries. That's why we need government. They protect us from foreign threats. We need government to protect us from domestic threats. And those domestic threats from our health come from big food. I'm sorry, John.
Those bastards.
So the government has a role because no individual or company can do it.
I hear you.
But otherwise, we don't have to.
So we have another question from the audience, and she or he has signed, "By the way, a plant-based diet cured my cancer." So there's a fan in the audience. That's a wonderful thing. So here she writes, "You've done plenty, but what are some of the things that other business people can do to make vegetable-based diets more accessible and cost-effective for more people?" The affordability question. It's a big issue. I mean, some people call Whole Foods Market whole paycheck. I'm sure you've heard that before. So
once or twice. So there's really two. There's two questions there. The question on affordability is one I hear all the time, and it's not really a very well-informed position, in my opinion, because the healthiest diet you can eat is the least expensive diet. If you know how to cook, if you can boil water and cook brown rice and you cook some beans and or cook potatoes and get some vegetables that are in season, you've spent pennies. I mean, like when I travel, for example, I travel with a rice cooker, and every morning I have steel-cut oats for breakfast, and I soak them overnight, turn it on in the morning, add a few berries to it, a little bit of unsweetened almond milk, and I've got a super nutritious meal that costs pennies. Really, that's all it costs. So the healthy diet, but yeah, sure, if you're going to eat all this highly processed foods, that's very expensive. But when you get back to the basics, when you begin eating real food again, it's not that expensive, particularly if you shop in the seasons. But you have to know how to cook, and increasingly fewer and fewer people seem to know how to do that. But there was a first part to that question.
What can other businesses do to make it more
affordable? Here's the thing. We're living in the most interesting, if you're a foodie, and probably a lot of people in this audience are, this is actually the most interesting time. I've seen the food system change more in the last 15 years, say, than probably the previous 1,000 years combined. Entrepreneurs are making major disruption right now. There's so many interesting things. There's food trucks everywhere. There's all the ethnic cuisines are available. In my lifetime, I mean, the ethnic cuisine when I was a kid was Italian food. And that was it. And I lived in Texas, so little tacos were starting to make their way up. But we did not have this. I remember Anita Bryant singing about orange juice from Florida when I was a kid, because it was frozen orange juice, but it was such a revolution. My God, you could drink orange juice in the middle of winter anywhere in America. That was like amazing. And there's been so much radical change that's occurred. Now you can get food delivered any place, anytime, and we're heading towards you can pretty much get whatever you want within like 30 minutes. It's astounding what's happening. And so entrepreneurs are making that happen. And by the way, it was so much harder to be, say, a vegan 20 years ago than it is today. There was no soy milk. There was no almond milk or flaxseed milk or cashew milk. None of that existed. Didn't exist. And tofu was like just becoming in our society 20 or 25 years ago. It was just really beginning to catch on. All types of these alternative meats and things like that, they didn't exist. It's astounding if you want to be a plant-based diet how much easier it is today than it was 20 years ago. And I might say Whole Foods has had quite a bit to do with that. And we don't, of course, get much credit for it, but we've probably done more to promote plant-based eating than any other company in the world.
Right. As we talked backstage, I knew we'd get some questions from the audience on entrepreneurship. Mm-hmm. Can you share your top three tips on starting a company and growing a company and maintaining a company, maintaining growth?
Yeah, that's like a 5-hour discussion, but but if we want some sound bites, it starts with purpose. What's the purpose? Why are you creating the business in the first place? And really today, entrepreneurs tend to be very passionate people. They have some kind of dream they're trying to realize in the world. I've known hundreds of entrepreneurs in my lifetime. Very few of them started their businesses just to get rich. I've met a few, but they're pretty rare. Most of them were on fire about some kind of passion they had, some kind of dream they wanted to realize. So the first thing to realize is that when you're on fire, when you're passionate about something, you're more likely to actually create something that's going to make a difference. So you've got to tap into that deeper, higher purpose for what you want to create. And we've always had that at Whole Foods. We've always had a sense of higher purpose in what we're doing. And secondly, then you need to attract people to your dream and vision that share it. Because one individual, America romances the heroic entrepreneur, but it's always a team. It's always a team. It's always a collection of people that are working together to create value, to fulfill the dream. And if you get really talented people working with you, like I have had, been blessed to have so many brilliant people working with me at Whole Foods, you can accomplish things together. And I think third, you've got to get business skills. There are basic business skills. It's not just having purpose and passion. It's about learning business. It's not easy to be skilled at business. It's like anything. You have to practice it, and you have to learn and educate yourself. You have to learn something about accounting. You need to learn things about finance. You need to learn things about inventory management if you're in retail. I mean, there's a lot of different skills you need to pick up. Business is sort of underrated by people that are not business people have no idea how difficult and complex business is. So you need to develop the skill sets that you need in order to be successful.
Great. And here's another question, follow-up question from the audience. As a public company, how can you balance long-term goals like healthy eating versus short-term goals like maximizing profits for this quarter?
God, it's such a good question. I would have answered it differently like 2 weeks ago than I would answer today, because Whole Foods now has shareholder activists in our stock that want us to force us into a selling the company. So the very short-term profit mentality is entered into our shareholder base, and we are definitely being challenged by it. Whole Foods has always had this purposeful, long-term perspective, but we're faced with probably the biggest challenge in the history of our company. Can we stay independent to fulfill our mission, or are we going to be sold out to the highest bidder for short-term gains for certain shareholder activists? Stay tuned. We'll find out in the next few months.
Is this something that you are personally just attached to forever? Do you see on your deathbed you'll still be CEO of Whole Foods? Is that?
I hope
something?
Not. I'll be dead pretty soon.
But I mean, you know, I mean, do you have like a retirement plan in place, or you know, if these protesters get
you? Oh, I'm moving to
you.
Florida. I mean, no, I mean, I think the real answer to that question is that I haven't taken any compensation at all from the company for 10 years. I am just doing it because I love it, because it's the purpose of my life, and I'm a servant leader. I'm just trying to serve Whole Foods and help it to prosper. And how many of you are parents out there? How many of you have children? So what wouldn't you do for your children? You'd do almost anything, wouldn't you? Well, that's how I feel about Whole Foods. Whole Foods is my child. I love it. I've given almost 40 years of my life to nurture it and develop it. And there's almost nothing I wouldn't do to protect it and keep it healthy and help it to flourish. And that's how I feel about it. So, however, there comes a time when Daddy has to leave, and that time is not yet, I hope. But
so you're going to hang on to it?
I'm not hanging on at all. It's about when, if it's appropriate, if it's still what my heart calls me to do, and it's still what is the appropriate thing to do, I'll continue to lead it. And there'll come a time when it's not appropriate any longer, and I believe I'll have the wisdom and the grace to recognize it, and I'll leave. But I don't think that time is right now.
Okay, so we have another question from a young entrepreneur in the audience. Mr. McKee, what...
Got it right.
I'm working on that, Mackie. What was a large obstacle you overcame when you first started out, and what was the lesson learned?
Well, there have been a lot of obstacles, right? You have a lot of obstacles. Probably the first big obstacle we had when Whole Foods opened, the first store, 10,000, Safeway went to Whole Foods. The first store was enormously successful. It became... very quickly, the highest volume natural food store in the United States. But we had a flood about 9 months in. Austin, we built this store in a 100-year floodplain. And I thought, well, so what? I mean, what does that mean? It means you have a flood once every 100 years. It's like, yeah, okay, great. We can handle that. Well, the first year we were open, we had the 100-year flood. And we had 8 feet of water in the store, and we were wiped out. We were broke. And that taught me probably one of the most important lessons I learned in business, though, because Whole Foods should have died. We should have died in that first year. We didn't have any money. We were broke. And our stakeholders saved us. And the next day after we were cleaning up from the flood, and we had all these people, and they were helping us clean up. And I recognized them kind of, but I knew they weren't team members. They weren't working for the company. So they were customers. They came in, and they heard that we needed help, and they were helping us to clean up the store. And they were mopping out the store and cleaning out the muck that happens when you have a flood. Our team members, we didn't have any money to make payroll, so they just worked for free. And of course, they got paid back eventually when we reopened, but there was no guarantee we would reopen. Our investors put more capital in. The bank loaned more money on my signature alone, which I assure you was worthless. And they didn't let us die. And so the big lesson I learned is that a company is, it's, I felt like Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life. And we have friends, and we, Whole Foods had friends, and we had people that loved us, and they didn't let us die. And I've never forgotten that. That's the first big obstacle, and it taught me probably the most important lesson I've learned in business.
Great. So we've got time for just one last question. And we talked last backstage about your hero, the Nobel Prize-winning economist Milton Friedman. And you end your book sharing an anecdote about a dinner you had with him and a challenge you set for him. Can you share that with us?
Yeah, this is in the book in that chapter 13 that I wish the protesters would read. So as an honor of my life, towards the end of my life, or end of Milton Friedman's life, I got to meet him and his wife Rose when they were 92 years old, and mutual friends introduced us, and he lived in San Francisco in Russian Hill, and so we were taking him out to dinner at the famous vegetarian restaurant Greens. So we picked up, we went over there, my wife and I went over there to pick up Milton and Rose, and of course he showed me his apartment, and showed me his Nobel Prize, which was super cool. And then he said, "So, John, why are you a vegan? Why are you a vegan?" And I said, "Well, I guess this was back in 2004. I said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Milton, I'm going to give you an argument. I know you like arguments. I'm going to give you an argument. If you can answer it, I'll stop being a vegan. However, if you can't answer it, I know you're a man of great intellectual integrity. I expect you to become a vegan." He said, "Okay." I said, "Well, there are four parts of the argument. The first part is that if you eat animals, the animal necessarily has to die. And if you're eating animals that were raised in America, over 99% of them grew up in factory farm conditions, and they were simply horrible. Number two, you don't need to eat animal foods in order to be healthy. In fact, you can eat a completely animal-free diet and have extremely good health if you do it in an unconscious, intelligent way. Number three, we eat animal foods primarily because that's what we learned to do. If we were enculturated, our families taught it to us, we learned to like it, and then we're supported by the larger culture, we're supported by our communities. It just seems perfectly normal. Number four, I can't justify eating animals just because it gives pleasure to me, it's a pleasure to my palate, so I don't eat them. How can you?" Okay, I told that to him. He got really quiet. He started thinking about it and thinking about it and thinking. I could tell the wheels were whirling in his brain. And then he looks at his watch and he says, "Oh, we got to go. We're going to be late to the restaurant." So we get into the car, and again, it's very quiet in the car. And except he's telling me, "You're going to take a right." This is before they had GPS. "Take a right here. No Google Maps. Take a left here." And so he's directing me to get to the restaurant. We get to the restaurant, and we sit down, and they pass out the menus. And I'm thinking, "Ah, okay, he's copping out here. He's not gonna answer the question." So we're all looking at our menus. And Milton Friedman then does something that completely astounded me. He stands up, and he throws his menu on the table. And he says, "Rose, I cannot answer to my satisfaction John's argument. I have no choice. From this point on, I'm going to become a vegan." And then the next thing that happened was also incredibly delightful. Rose, his wife, stands up, and these are little people. Milton and Rose are like 4'10". They're really, really short people. She stands up, throws her menu on the table, and says, "Milton, don't be ridiculous. We are 92 years old. It is too late for us to become vegans." So they died. Milton died a couple of years later. He actually, I think he fell and he might have had a heart attack, but he fell and hit his head and he passed away. So I don't know whether he became a vegan or not. I'd like to think he did, because he was a man of very high intellectual integrity, in my opinion. Or whether his wife of over 70 years won the argument. As a happily married man, probably the latter. That's my experience in those kind of arguments. So anyway, that's that story.
Great. That's a great story. So I hope you enjoy this evening's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. We're celebrating over 114 years of enlightened discussion. We would like to thank John Mackey, CEO of Whole Foods, and Dr. John McDougall, and our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio and online. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.